At this time, we'd like to welcome our speaker tonight, which is Nicole S. from Feet First.
Hi, everybody. Nicole, alcoholic.
Hi.
I'd like to apologize. You came to hear like a good out-of-town speaker, and you got me. kind of by default, it just so happens like my sponsor is a speaker getter. So when she found out that the person couldn't make it due to the bad weather, the elements, she let me know that I would be speaking. you don't really say no to your sponsor, you know, and I'm like, oh my God. Because to me, this meeting is like, I guess like my head says this meeting is like a big deal, you know. This was my very first AA meeting. I actually came here with my dad. I want to say a good 5 years ago. He had went through like a, he was going through a divorce, and I had been going to a different fellowship, and I, you know, had some kind of chip on my shoulder, and he was like telling me about like, you know, how sad and depressed, and he, you know, I was kind of worried that maybe he would drink, and I was like, well, Dad, what do you think you're cured? You need to go back to AA, you know. and my dad's been sober pretty much as long as I was alive, so that was like a pretty like, you know, ballsy thing to say, you know. I'm like, Dad, you need to go back to AA. And you know, it's kind of funny because God used me in that experience because he did come back to AA, and it probably saved his butt, you know, because I drink when I'm in pain. You know, I drink when I can't handle life, when things seem to be too difficult, and that's kind of what was happening for him. And it's funny because my, you know, thank God used my dad to save my butt, you know. So anyways, I was in this other fellowship, and he invited me down here, and I remember coming down here, and it was, like, packed. I was, like, really intimidated, and I was, like, just trying to come in, and my dad's like, oh, you got to meet so-and-so, you got to meet so-and-so, and I was, like, just, like, I felt really out of place, and I had no idea years later this would be my home group. I would be in a totally different fellowship, and, you know, I would be living, like, a life that is, like, pretty much beyond my wildest dreams. You know, it's not very exciting or anything, but I definitely live a responsible, productive, for the most part, happy life, you know. You know, this meeting, when I got to AA, I came here, and they were talking about things that, like, I had never heard. Like, I've been in and out. I'm, like, 28, you know, and I've been coming to AA and other 12-step fellowships since I'm maybe 14 or 15. And, like, I don't know if they weren't talking about it or if I just wasn't hearing it, but I didn't know, like, they were saying, like, a step a year, like, take your time, there's no rush. And I came here, and I, you know, heard people talking about, like, let's do the steps, like, let's do it fast, let's, you know, get you well, let's, you can recover, you know, things like that. And, you know, I wanted what the people that I heard speak here had. And, you know, so I joined the home group and, like, eventually, you know, like, became, like, a member and actually, like, you know, showed up at business meetings and, you know, like, occasionally I'll make coffee, you know, like, I get to go to intergroup for this group, just be of service, you know. I don't know. So anyway, you know, my sobriety date, it's June 4th, 2011. I get a little stuck when I'm saying my sobriety date because I've had so many. Like, I'm like, okay, wait, what was it? My girlfriend and I went to speak. We took a meeting into a rehab, and I went to go take my sobriety date, and my mind went blank. And I'm looking at her, I'm like, when's my sobriety date, you know? Because, like, that's not, to me, very – it is very important, but it's just the fact, like, I don't believe that my time really means anything, you know, because I've had periods of sobriety, you know, like, just being plain dry for like, 2 years or something, thinking that I had something going on, and I was dying inside. And that's really my experience, you know. Like I said, I've been doing this in-and-out thing – probably for a good 10, 11 years, you know, I had no idea that there was, like, a solution. Like, I thought we just came to meetings and we complained about our problems and we kind of, like, you know, white-knuckled it and we were fighting, like, this war against our disease and, like, all this crazy stuff. Like, I had no idea, like, what AA really was, you know. So, I don't know. I guess I kind of feel like maybe I had some, like, wacky behavior as a kid, because I remember doing things like telling lies a lot, you know, like, I didn't want anyone to be mad at me, so I would, like, tell lies. I remember having conversations with my dad, like, he'd be like, why don't you just, you know, tell the truth, you know, and my mom would say things to me like, the world doesn't revolve around you, you know, so obviously I was pretty self-centered, like, from the get-go, you know, you know, the world doesn't revolve around you, are you sure? you know, I don't know, like, a lot of people can stand up here and they can remember a lot about their childhood. I don't, like, have, like, a whole lot of memories. Occasionally, if someone, like, reminds me of a situation, like, I can kind of remember it. But I don't really have, like, any clear, like, memories of actual feelings or anything like that until about, like, you know, right going into middle school. And I kind of remember, like, being, like, feeling separate from my group of friends. You know, I felt like all my friends were really pretty and I wasn't. And I felt like they were all really smart and I wasn't. And I felt like nobody liked me, even though I had all these, you know, like, I just felt, like, weird, you know, like, it just didn't feel right. And I think, like, I was, like, a pretty good kid and stuff like that until about sixth grade I started getting in trouble. Like, I would be, like, I thought it was funny to be, like, you know, disruptive and get thrown out of class. And, you know, like, I thought that that was, like, cool. And so, like, basically it started some trouble for me. And probably, like, you know, my freshman year is when it really got kind of, like, icky. You know, like, it was the summer before freshman year, and I went to this party at my with one of my girlfriends. She had an older brother. And it was, like, they had this big backyard because, like, out here you can party out in, like, in the woods and, like, nobody catches you, you know. And we were at this party, and I got really drunk. I had never drank before, and I don't know that I knew what I was doing, but, like, I remember I picked up one, and I just kept drinking. And I remember not remembering. Like I remember waking up in the morning and being like, what happened? And, you know, other people did remember, and they filled me in. And I wasn't too pleased about the things that I had done. And I don't know if I drank alcoholically that day, but I just know I blacked out. It talks about in our book, like, at some point in our drinking, the line between being able to stop and not being able to stop gets crossed. And I've had conversations with my sponsor, you know, and I guess it doesn't really matter when that happens, but what matters is it does happen, and then that's what makes me alcoholic. It wasn't like I became, like, a weekend drinker right away or anything. Like, I just became a drinker. I liked it, and I kept doing it. And all my friends were able to, like, continue, like, going to school and doing all the things that they were doing and, like, drink occasionally and maybe do some of that green stuff, smoke some of that green stuff. But I really like to drink, and I started hanging out with kids that were older than me that drank. And the trouble with that was, you know, I stopped wanting to go to school, and I did anything I could to get out of the house and go drink. I think I ran away one time from home. We lived in a trailer park, and I, like, went to a couple trailers down, and that was my running away. But either way, I didn't come home for, like, a couple days, and, like, I don't know. It was, you know, and I basically just tormented the crap out of, like, my mom and my dad, and you know, like, I had no idea. Like, I thought, like, I was having fun, and they were, like, really interrupting that for me, and they should just leave me alone, you know, and let me do what I was doing, and, like, you know, didn't really see a problem with it. And, you know, but they did, and this is kind of funny. Like, I think I was probably, dad, was I 15 when I went to rehab? I was 15, and my dad said he would buy me a carton of cigarettes if I went to rehab. I'm like, all right, you know, like, I'm there, carton of cigarettes, all right. So I did. I went to my first rehab, and you know, basically met other kids that were doing, like, the same stuff that I was doing, and that's really where it got, like, a whole lot worse for me, because I had, prior to that, just been basically drinking and, you know, getting into trouble at school and stuff like that. And, you know, when I got out of there, I had to go to, like, a special school for, like, kids that didn't behave. And, you know, like, basically never wanted to go, and I wanted to drink. And I got this job waitressing, and I thought that, like, I was, like, so great. I was making all this money, what I thought was a lot of money, and I didn't really need school. And my mom was pretty sick of the school calling her, threatening her with truancy fines. So she was like, okay, I turned 60. She's like, we're dropping out. You know, like, we're just, you know, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to fight you every day to go to school. And so that's what I did. And I was pleased with that. I was okay with that. I'm like, I'll get my GED and go to college one day, and it's really not that big of a deal. What happened was, you know, I'm an alcoholic. Like, I have the mental obsession and the physical allergy. I'm definitely an alcoholic. But Bob Darrell says it best, like, I'm alcoholic, I'm real alcoholic, and alcoholics do not do drugs. And I'm going to, because they do drugs alcoholically. And I think that puts it perfectly. I'm not going to really go into, like, my drug use, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. But I really think it's important that I touch on it, because for a long time, I didn't know I was alcoholic because I looked like a drug addict. When you're doing the kind of things that I was doing. Nobody thinks that you're alcoholic. They think you're a drug addict. And that might have killed me. You know, if I never would have found out, like if no one ever opened the big book and showed me, in the doctor's opinion, where it talks about what makes me alcoholic, I might be dead. Because that's, I can't treat it, like I have to treat, I need to know what I'm treating. And when you're doing the kind of things that I was doing, people looked at me, thought I was a drug addict, and just dismissed my alcoholism, like my alcoholism, which, you know, like every time that I would go into a relapse, I would pick up a drink because I didn't think I was alcoholic and I could have one drink. So I was very deluded about what my problem was for a long time. And I think, I don't know for sure, but I think that that happens to a lot of us. We get misdiagnosed. We don't know what it is that makes us alcoholic. We don't know about the spiritual malady. We don't know that there's two things that make us alcoholic. And I said that. One is the mental obsession, which means that when I am not drinking, I cannot stop thinking about drinking. I'm completely obsessed about when I'm going to drink again, how I can get the next one, how I can hide it from mom, how I can get away with it. And then the allergy, which is once I put that drink in my body, I have no idea when I'm going to stop. Those are the two things that make me alcoholic. I didn't know that for a very long time. And, you know, in addition to that, what we really suffer from is a spiritual malady. Basically, like the bedevilments on page 52, which if you don't know about those, we could talk after the meeting because I had no idea what those were either. And basically, it's like I'm a prey to misery and depression. I'm feeling useless. I can't make a decent living. You know, like I'm full of fear. And that sometimes looks like mental disorders. And, you know, like I was also diagnosed with many of those too. And I found out I'm just an untreated alcoholic. So anyways, I don't know. You know, we'll just get through this war story stuff as fast as possible here. You know, basically when I, you know, the drug use continued. And when I think the reason that I went to drugs was because when I drank, I was such a raving lunatic. I blacked out. I woke up places I didn't know. I smashed my mom's windows out. I drove drunk and almost, like, killed myself, smashed cars, did all these crazy things. But when I did drugs, I just kind of sat in one place and was, like, falling asleep. So I think that what happened was I just simply was like, okay, well, that drinking stuff is, like, really getting a little crazy. Maybe I'll just, you know, stick to the stuff that doesn't make me behave so wacky. But that really didn't work out too well either because by the time I was 18, I was, you know, my friends were going to college and I was in Lehigh County prison. And I'll tell you what, I was in that jail like, man, like no one would talk to me. My dad and my mom, they were like done. I had stolen checks from my grandma who had Alzheimer's and she, I don't even remember how much I stole, but I know it, you know, it was not just a little bit, and I had been robbing her. Like, I would go to her house and talk to her, and then I would steal the checks, and then I would go cash them. And, you know, I can tell you, like, that grandma has since passed away, but I help my dad take care of my other grandma, and I look at her today, and I can't imagine ever stealing a thing from that woman. You know what I mean? But that's what, like, I had to do to feed my my addiction. You know, like I was willing to do whatever I had to do to get the next one. And it didn't really matter who I hurt and who I stole from and, you know, what consequences I was going to have to pay. So I'm in jail and I'm pissed off that no one will talk to me. I can't believe my parents are such bad parents. They won't even talk to me. Nobody's taking my phone calls. They won't send me money. What is wrong with them? You know, like giving myself the whole pity party. And, you know, our big book talks about, like, given, like, there's the different drinkers, like, type 1 and type 2 and even type 3 can stop with sufficient reason. To me, going to jail should be sufficient reason. Like, I was in there like, oh, hell no. Like, this is not, like, where I want to be. I'm going to get out of here, and I am never, ever, ever drinking again or doing drugs. Like, I am never, ever going to do that again. And I meant that. Like, I really did mean that. I never wanted to do that stuff ever again. But the problem is, and it says it right behind me, that lack of power was our dilemma. I don't have the power to not drink. I don't have that power on my own, and I didn't know that. And, you know, I got out of there with every intention of not doing the stuff that I was doing, and it didn't work. I continued on doing the exact same thing that I was doing. I think I wish I had a better memory, but I really even think I stole another check from my grandma after that, before she passed away. I don't remember getting caught for it, but I really think I did. And that'll just, like, you know, that kind of stuff, like, how do you make that right? Robbing your grandmom that has Alzheimer's, you know, and to feed your addiction, you know, like, how do you make that stuff right? You know, we have a nine step that, like, we can try, but, like, I think of that stuff today, and it still, like, kind of breaks my heart. So anyway, you know, that went on for a couple years, I think, like, probably from, like, 18 to, like, 20. I continued to be in and out of rehabs, in and out of detoxes. I remember one of my overdoses, I got Narcan, and I woke up, and I had been sleeping for, like, 4 days, and they told my mom I wasn't going to wake up. And I remember she was, like, rubbing my hand, like, telling me, like, wake up, wake up, wake up. And I woke up, and they found out that I had a hole in my heart. And I remember the doctor saying to me, you know, like, you could get this disease around your heart. It's like endocarditis, I don't know, some big E word, and die if you continue to do what you're doing. This will happen to you. And I remember I was like, well, that would suck, but, you know, that's not going to happen to me. And the hospital that I was in was, like, literally across the street from my bartender, and they let me out, and, like, I continued to do what I was doing. Never mind the fact that, like, my whole entire family was thinking that, like, I was going to die. That stuff did not matter. What mattered was, like, I needed to feel better. The only time I ever felt okay and like I could do life is when I had a substance in my body. And when I would be in my periods of sobriety, as, you know, they say, I was just what the book says, restless, irritable, and discontent. Because just not drinking and using doesn't work for me. For a type 4 real alcoholic, that doesn't work. I need something to replace that. You know, and I don't really remember how I ended up getting clean or sober again, but I think I went back to jail. You know, I did go, yeah, I definitely went back to jail. you know, I got arrested with this guy, and he was, like, you know, like, the best, because he, like, had this really, he was, like, really ghetto, and he was, like, you know, he was a drug dealer, and he was just so cool, and we got arrested together, and I was, like, you know, he was, like, the love of my life for that. And we went to jail, and we were co-defendants, so we could, like, write each other. He was, like, downstairs, I was, like, upstairs, and we were allowed to write, and we were in love. From those 3 months of being in jail, we were in love, writing back and forth to each other. And we were so in love that when I got out, I got pregnant. Now, he was still in there, so tell me, I don't know how that works out. But I just say that because, like, it's a delusion. Like, I really believe, like, you know, this was God. Like, God put this person in my life, and we were going to be together forever. And I get out, and I get pregnant. Like, you know, he's still in there. So it just doesn't add up. And I remember thinking to myself, like, this is it. You know, he's going to get out. We're going to get married. You know, like, it's all going to be different. But then this happened. And, you know, because he was really sick, too, you know, when I let him know about my current situation, he didn't even care. He was like, well, I forgive you, and I'll help you raise a baby. Now, here we are, two, like, crazies, you know, like, really deluded, sick people. You know, he's going to get out and raise my baby, and it's all going to be good. And I really believe that. I thought, like, having a kid, like, any mom would get sober, right? Like, a mom loves their baby. I'm going to love this baby, and he's going to save me, and it's going to be great. And, like, it would have been nice if it, like, worked out that way, but that is not how it went at all. You know, and for the next 5 years, the two of us basically tortured each other and my son. You know, I remember, like, he didn't want to stay there, and, you know, he got out of jail. They put him in a rehab, and he ends up escaping to my house. And it just so happens I live three like, blocks down from where he escaped from, and, you know, the parole's kicking in the door, and, you know, like, I'm like, no, you know, and it was pretty dramatic, and he went back to jail, and, you know, there I was, now I'm alone, you know, I'm just not drinking and not using, I'm pregnant, I'm alone, you know, and I'm like, what am I gonna do? And, you know, God graced me with some determination, because I was able to stay sober for that pregnancy, and for the first couple years of my son's life. I think after he was 6 months old, I one night went out on like a weekend bender, like, you know, my son was colic, and so he cried a lot, you know, I was really young, and I was just stressed, and I was like, I worked really hard, I'm going to go have a beer at the bar downstairs from my apartment, because I'm not alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, right, so I can have, like, a beer. And, like, 3 days later, I had stolen, like, my own rent money from myself, and, you know, like, my mom can't find me, and I left my six-month-old baby with his dad, and I was out, you know, off to the races, and God graced me, because, like, he pulled me back from that, and I was able to stay sober for probably another three years, just out of, I think, complete fear. Because for me, like, I hear old-timers say stuff like, you know, I spilled more beer than you drank, or this other crazy stuff that they say, but, like, for me, and it says in our book, like, that, like, for women, like, we get bad fast. It doesn't say it like that, but basically it's saying, like, sometimes it's especially true in women that we get really bad really fast. And that was my experience. Like, I would, like, it would be 6 months, and it would be, like, so ugly that, you know, like, it was unbearable. You know, I was talking to my friend Stacy last night. She spoke, and she went 18 years. And I'm thinking, man, like, imagine all the damage I would have done in 18 years of straight, because it would get so ugly so fast. And, you know, like, the things that I would end up having to do to continue to do what I was doing were just, like, our book talks about the incomprehensible demoralization, and I definitely know what that means. You know, I know what that means. Today, it's like a gift. I try to look at it that way because I can help other women with that, but, you know, out there, it wasn't very pretty. You know, I was in this other fellowship, and they didn't really do things the way we do. We didn't use a big book. It was like, do a step a year. And I thought the solution was, like, if I had a family for my son, then, like, it would all be good. And I met this boy, and he was, you know, he was in the same fellowship as me, and his parents had a lot of money, and he seemed like a half-decent guy. And I had an apartment, and he was like, well, you know, you're going to beauty school, so maybe you should, like, give up your apartment and move into my house, and we'll just, you know, do that. You know, we'll be a family. He had a daughter. I had my son, and it'll be good. And I was like, yeah, that would be really good. I think that's what we need to do. We should do that. And so that's what we did. And, you know, I really didn't run that by anybody besides my mom. And she's like, that's a really bad idea. Like, don't give up your apartment and move in there. You know, don't do that. And I found out later he didn't really want, I don't think, a relationship. He just wanted someone to pay half the bills. I wanted, like, a husband and a family. And I don't think really that's what he wanted. It didn't go well. I'll tell you what, like, because this is why, like, I know that, like, a relationship is not going to fix me. Having a loving-looking family that looks perfect on the outside for my son is not going to fix me. You know, like, thinking I need to keep up with the Joneses and have this life that looks this certain way, it's not what is going to fix me. And I still get stuck with that. Sometimes I think, well, if I was married and had a family for my son, it'll be different. It'd be better, right? But that's not true. You know, it's just a lie that my mind tells me, you know. So basically what happens is, like, I think we're getting married and, you know, having this beautiful life. And he, like, he's bringing some girl in the house when I'm at work and they're, you know, I don't know what, you know, what they're doing. And the one day I catch him, you know. So I'm, like, trying to get him. I come home from work early, and I'm, like, opening the door, but it won't open because there's a dresser in front of it. And, you know, and it's funny now. It wasn't that, but I finally get him to let me in. He has no shirt on, and I walk to the back door because, like, this is not my first rodeo yet, and I see this girl walking down, you know, outside, and he's, like, and I'm looking at him, like, and he's looking at me, and I'm, like, was that girl in this house? And he's, like, of course not. You know, and I'm like, okay, but you know, I do, and you know, because he didn't want to admit it, and I guess, you know, I could see why he didn't want to, like, admit that that's what he was up to, and you know, because I didn't, I knew what he was doing and didn't want to call him on it. You know, like, I started doing some things, you know, like, I started hanging out with the girls I was going to school with, and I started talking to other guys, and it was just really now a war because you got me and I'm going to get you. And it was not, you know, it was really ugly. And what happened was, like, I tell this because I think it's really important because, like, we come in here and we want to get in a relationship and we want to, you know, like, start fixing everything and we don't fix what's really wrong with us. And when stuff like this happens, people can die. Because I stopped going to the only thing which was kind of like my lifeline at the time. I stopped going to meetings. He stopped going to meetings. And, you know, I became very sick. And I was never going, you know, and he eventually said, I needed to leave. I forget exactly how it happened, but he said I had to go. And I was crushed because I had given up my apartment. I had now given up the dream of my son having a normal family. And I was moving back to my mom's house with nothing because we had given away all my furniture and everything that I had so that I could move in with this guy. And I was like, you know what? I am never going back to that 12-step fellowship because all those people, they're really messed up. And because I equated them with him, you know, and I my ego was hurt and I didn't want them to know. And I decided I was never, ever going back there. And that could have killed me. And it probably does kill a lot of people, you know, because, like, you know, that kind of pain and that kind of, like, delusion that we get stuck in, that's the stuff that makes me drink. And just, you know, kind of like, long story short, what ended up happening was since I was never going back to that 12-step fellowship and I wasn't alcoholic, I was a drug addict, I decided that I was going to drink because I could just drink right. And that is when I really found out, like, what my true problem really is. I'm an alcoholic. I met this guy, and I say this is kind of funny, and he had just got out of jail for attempted murder, and he was the one. And I didn't really like him until I found out he just got out of jail for, you know, like, that was, like, really great to me. I don't know. Like, this is how sick I was sober, you know. And he and I proceeded to, I guess we thought we were, like, some kind of Bonnie and Clyde, you know, like, we were, like, on this mission, like, we were gonna sell pharmaceuticals until we made $50,000, and we were gonna open up a barbershop / salon, because he went to school for barbering, and I went to school for aesthetics, so that made perfect sense. The problem was, I had a 3-year-old son that I was dragging with me, and this is where, like, I really get stuck, because, you know, I had always thought I was a good mom, you know, like, I didn't really know how to do it that good. But, you know, I worked and I bought diapers and I loved that little kid, you know, to the best of my ability I did. And I had pretty much been sober his whole entire life. And in that 9 months, I managed to put him in some really bad situations that could have got him hurt, got him taken away. And I love that little kid, you know, but my drinking, he wasn't going to get in the way of my drinking, and he wasn't going to get in the way of my plan, our plan. We were going to have, this is what we were doing, we were going to get the $50,000, but it doesn't work out too good when he's trying to, like, sell these things and I'm stealing them. Like, we're never going to make any money, because that's eventually what happened, you know. I'm drinking, and he's, like, asking me to stop because, like, the cops are getting called. I'm trying to, like, throw him out of the car while it's moving. Like, because, like, that's how I get when I drink. And I don't even remember doing any of it. I'm drinking, like, a bottle of vodka a day. We're driving all around. I've got my son in the backseat. I remember one night at midnight, we're even at Walmart buying my son a bike so he'll be quiet so we can take e-pills and sell whatever we were selling all night long. And I don't think that that's funny, and I don't think that that's cool. But I say that because, like, it's the truth. That's what I did. You know, that is what I did. And, it just so happens, like, both of us got really violent when we were drinking, and what would happen was I would, like, have black eyes, and I would drop my son off at my mom's, and then I couldn't go pick him up because I didn't want her to see what I looked like. So I started leaving my son at my mom's for long periods of time, and I would not come get him. And she eventually, when he would come with me, he could talk, so he would start telling her things like Mom Joey was going to throw Mommy down the steps, and she would sometimes have to come up to the house because I'd be like, Mommy's going to kill me. I really think he's going to kill me. You got to come up here. And she would come up and, you know, like, have to, like, save me from this self-created, like, insanity, you know. And one day I called to get him, my son, and she said, I'm sorry, but you can't have him. And I was really angry. Like, how could could she do this to me? Nobody's taken my little boy from me. I couldn't even see how I had been harming him, how I had been harming her, how sick the situation that he was in was. I couldn't even see it. And I was angry at her. And I was angry at her for quite some time after that. Because that's how we are. Book says we're selfish and self-centered, and that is the root of our troubles. Like, it was all about me and what I wanted to do and what you were doing to me and how wrong you were. And I'll never forget that day when I had that call with my dad, and he was trying to explain to me why it was better for me to just sign custody over my son to my mom, because I just couldn't take care of him right. And I don't know if any, like, parents in here, but, like, to hear that was some pretty devastating stuff. But what was even worse was when we went to court and my mom had asked me to, like, please just sign these papers in case anything happens. The judge asked me if I had anything to say for myself, and I didn't have anything to say because I wasn't ready to stop drinking. I think that was the worst part of it all. Because I was not ready to stop drinking, and I did not have anything to say for myself. And, you know, after that, like, I just kept saying, like, they took everything from me. Now I really am going to get it in. You know, and what happened was my girlfriend called the cops on the boyfriend because he had a warrant for his arrest. They raided my house. We get kicked out. I'm living in my car. And it was probably the worst time of my life. You know, I had nothing. I had no one. I had lost every friend I had. No one would speak to me. I clearly remember, like, I ended up in the hospital with, you know, had all my ribs were broken before the boyfriend went to jail. And my dad was begging me to come home, like, please just come live with me, please. And I was like, Dad, I can't do that because I wasn't ready to stop drinking. And, you know, like, I can't imagine, you know, my little boy being in some kind of situation like that. And I'm like, no, he's going to die. And I'm saying, please come with me, buddy, and he won't come. Like, I can't imagine what that pain must feel like. I can't. You know, it's like that kind of stuff. Like, how do you make that right? How do you make that right? You know, and those 6 months or however long it was, like I said, I wasn't allowed to see my son. I had pretty much burned every bridge. And I, like, the things that I was doing was pretty ugly. And, you know, I really believe I needed that to happen. Because that was when I had the gift of desperation. You know, it was my birthday, I guess, in 2000, I want to say 10. My mom called me, and she's like, she hadn't spoken to me in months. And I had called her, like, stalkingly every day, like, you're keeping my son from me. I want to talk to my son. And she wouldn't answer. But something told her to call me that day and let me see my son on my birthday. And what happened was I went there, and I held my little boy, who I hadn't seen in 3 months, and he was so, because they love you, you know, like, he didn't forget who I was, and he didn't want to let go, and God gave me some grace, and he gave me a moment of clarity, and I left there, because I was like, Mom, you're not going to let me sleep over. She's like, no, and I'm like, what, you know, and I ended up going to St. Luke's and checking myself in, and they do this thing, they want you to go to this drug and alcohol intake thing, but, like, I don't know about you, but if I was leaving there, I was going to drink. So I told them, I said, listen, I'm suicidal. I'm going to kill myself if you don't let me stay here. And they did. And they put me in, you know, the nice little hospital that we take the meeting into, you know. And I remember for, like, the first week, I don't even know that I knew I was there, but I did make one phone call, and it was to my dad. And I was pretty sure he wasn't going to talk to me. And he picked up the phone. And he came over to visit me, you know, and I'm pretty sure that's all because he remembered that day when I said, Dad, maybe you should go back to AA. So it's, like, really funny. It's like God used me to help him, and then God used him to help me. And I think that's really how that works. It's like this whole thing works. It's like God just uses us to help other people, and that's really the cool part, you know. And, you know, I didn't have any plans to come into AA and still didn't really think I was alcoholic. Thought I was a drug addict. And what happened was my dad said, like, you're not driving your car because it's illegal, because he does everything, like, by the book, which really irritates me. He, like, does live principles and all his affairs. It's like, come on, Dad, just cheat a little, you know, come on. And I wasn't allowed to drive my car because it wasn't inspected or something, and so I had to go to AA. And I'll tell you what, I'll never forget the woman. She came and picked me up, and I went to this woman's meeting. There was, like, five women there, and I knew that I was home. I knew that I was home. And I started coming to this meeting on a regular basis, and they were talking about things, like I said, that I had never, ever heard. Like, we can recover. We do recover. Practicing principles, living happy, joyous, and free. Talking about what our real problem is. And I was, like, really attracted to that. And I remember it was, like, the summertime, so we're outside, and it was, like, you know, I wanted whatever was going on here. You know, I wanted what these people had. And, you know, that's when I got a sponsor, and she opened the doctor's opinion and explained to me what my real problem was, and that, you know, I pretty much, like, the alcohol and the drugs were just a symptom of what my real problem is. You know, alcohol and drugs were my solution, you know, to my spiritual malady. And, you know, that's when I really found out, like, yeah, I am alcoholic, and this is where I belong. And she asked me how fast I wanted to get better. And I said, like, yesterday. And she was like, okay. And then we started in the work, and, like, we didn't wait. And there was, like, and she took me right through the book. You know, she was an awesome sponsor. You know, she really taught me, you know, a lot. Like, she picked me up. She brought me to meetings. She, you know, she taught me about, like, accountability. And, you know, I'd like to say that I stayed sober since then, but, you know, I didn't. Probably Mother's Day 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, I had been not sponsoring. Well, I was sponsoring myself. I fired my sponsor because she said something I didn't like, and that was it. And I was sponsoring myself, and I really quickly got really sick. What happened was that boyfriend that I had for 5 years, I was telling you, he was the one, he was my drug dealer. We ended up in jail together. He ended up overdosing and dying. And I had not, the last thing I had ever said to him was, like, don't contact me anymore. And a week later, my mom called me to let me know that he had passed away. And I'll tell you something, like, the ninth step is really important. Had I made amends to him, had I really done amends, like, I may not have suffered from that guilt and shame and remorse. And I was unable to talk about that with anyone because I was sponsoring myself. What ended up happening was I ended up getting really, really, really crazy and sick. And I remember it was Mother's Day. It was around Mother's Day, and I was supposed to drive my little sister to the prom. And my mind said, like, you can just have, like, one drink, drop your sister off at prom, go drink a little bit more, and then go back and get her, and nobody will know. And, you know, it just doesn't work that way. If you're an alcoholic, that's not how it goes. It's like, no matter how many times I want to tell myself it's going to go like that, it is not going to go like that. And what really happened was, you know, I took my sister to prom. I went and I had a couple too many drinks, and then I went and picked her up an hour and a half late. Now, I love my little sister, and I would never do that to her sober. I left her in the freezing cold waiting with her date late, her big sister, you know, left her at prom late. And I continued to drink for a couple days. And the thing about it is, like, you know, like, people in AA, they came and got me, and they gave me some help. And that's pretty much, like, God uses people to help, you know, to help me. And I got a new sponsor, and she was really, like, by the book. And she's like, you're not living right. You're not practicing principles in all your affairs. You're sponsoring yourself, and it's going to stop. And she was really hard on me, and she told me the truth. And she said, you're going to learn how to show up. You're going to learn how to be where you say you're going to be. You're going to start helping other women. You're going to really, really do this thing. And you know, she was kind of, like, mean. And, you know, she hurt my feelings a lot. But she saved my life. Because she understood that, like, she had to sometimes tell me things I didn't want to hear to be able to help me. And she took me through the steps. And you know what? Like, something happened that had never happened for me before. Like, I felt free. You know, I started feeling free. I started feeling, like, the peace and happiness that, like I had never felt in my life. Now, I don't feel it all the time. And sometimes I just downright don't want to be happy. And I like being mad and angry. And I'm, like, but she showed me this whole entire new way of life. And I love that we read the set-aside prayer, because we open, every time we would sit together, we would talk about that, the set-aside prayer. Because I had so many old ideas. Like, when you come in here, in and out, and out, you think you know what you're supposed to do. But the truth is, I didn't know anything. And I had to really find that out. Like, I didn't really know what I was doing. I had to listen to everything she told me to do. And, you know, she saved my butt. And she started talking to me about the 10th step. Which I know we have a 10-step, but I had never really done one. You know, now, like, 10-step is like, you know, like whenever we feel this selfishness, self-centeredness, you know, fear, like, we you know, pause immediately, we call someone, and then, you know, we talk about it, and then we turn our attention to someone to help, and we can help. And that's how I stay. I don't want to say, like, it helps me be awake and aware to what I'm really going on. Because, like, if I don't watch my mind, like, my mind will have me drinking. Because I can't control what I think, but I can watch what I think, you know. And basically, like, I don't want to go through the steps up here, but I will. in step one, like, I found out that, like, the unmanageability they were talking about wasn't the fact that I couldn't be anywhere on time. I mean, that's unmanageable, but it was the fact of how I was feeling on the inside all my life. Like, I was feeling like I was useless. I didn't feel like I was helpful to anyone. I just felt depressed. I felt miserable. That's the unmanageability that they're talking about in step one. And in step two, I really needed to have, like, some kind of idea of a God of my own understanding. And I have a new sponsor, and she took me through, she's taking me back through the steps, and I really had a second step experience. We did a couple exercises. Like, I knew that I believed in God. I knew that there was God, but I was not connected with him at all. And it was because, you know, we did this exercise where we talked about, like, my ideas of God, and, like, what I found out was, like, I'm so arrogant. Like, I believe in God, but I don't think he's doing his job good. You know what I mean? Like, he's not doing it right, you know? Like, he's forgetting about this. Like, why isn't he paying attention to this? Like, and so now, like, I'm really aware to the fact that, like, I think that I know better than God, and that, you know, like, I need other women to tell me, like, you're delusional and you're playing God, so just stop, you know? Like, because I thought I knew how everything was supposed to look. It was supposed to look this way or that way, or this person was supposed to behave this way, but, like, I'm not in charge. God is, you know? And I think that's really important. Like, if you haven't had a second step experience, you need to have a second step experience. and, you know, step three, turn my will, my life, over to the care of God. You know, I never really understood that. And basically, like, you don't have to. You just have to – you're making a decision to do the rest of the steps. And four and five, I think are the, like – I like those steps a lot. You know, everyone says, like, I had a counselor in rehab tell me that, like, I couldn't do that step because it would make me drink. She's like, you have to, like, you can't go ahead and do that. You need to do that in, like, a safe environment, like, inside this room with me. But that's just that's bull crap, you know. The fourth step is probably the most freeing thing you'll ever do. You know, you basically are just taking a look at, like, the things you did, but they're not who you are. You know, and I found, like, a lot when I was doing my first four-step with my sponsor, she had, I thought, like, these things were, like, terrible. She's like, oh, I did that, like, all the time, you know, I did that, and I know such and such, you know, of my friends did this, you know, she, you know, it was like, I just thought, like, all these things I had done were, like, really horrible, and, like, I was, like, the worst, you know, and here, like, everybody has stuff, especially if you're, you know, like us, you know, we do lots of things out there that we don't really, like, we normally wouldn't do if we were sober. And, you know, the fifth step is sharing that. And, like, I've since had the privilege to listen to other women do their fourth and fifth step, and I've been able to say to them, oh, that's nothing, I did that, you know. And it's, like, it's pretty neat, because we're taking all those things that are, like, haunting us in our mind, and we're looking at them, and we're doing an honest appraisal, like, that's not who I am. It's what I did. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes I start in morbid reflection and start to get confused and think that's who I am. But I have women in my life who remind me that, like, that's not who I am. It's just what I did. You know, six and seven, pretty much willing to have God remove my defects, you know, which sometimes I am and sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I like being angry. Sometimes I like, you know, being defiant. Sometimes I like being right at any cost, you know. But, you know, right? You don't? you know, and then the eighth and ninth steps, pretty, you know, I've had some pretty cool men's experience. I just want to, you know, one of them real fast. I, like I said, like, I believe that my lack of action on my amends is what made me drink a year and a half ago. Well, one of my biggest things was, you know, like, and I believe that, like, we're not going to get better in relationships until we start making some of the amends for things we've done in relationships. Like, I just believe that. I mean, it's been my experience. And God put my grand sponsor in my life to help me with this amends. You know, my ex-boyfriend, he had died. We were together 5 years. He helped raise my son. And we were really sick together. And through my fourth and fifth step, I always thought it was him. I could really see how I tormented him. You know, because he did die, still telling his sister, like, I don't know why she won't talk to me. I want to just talk to her. You know, and he died, like, with me having the last things I ever said to him. Like, I don't ever want to talk to you again. Leave me alone. And that brought a lot of guilt for me. there was this thing called a proxy amends, and you know, basically you write a letter and you read it to someone that you trust and you know, that understands what you're doing, and they speak as if they were that person on what they could do to make it right. And I don't know if some people may not believe in that or whatever, but for me it was a really powerful experience because my grand sponsor, he's awesome. He was willing to listen to my letter, and he didn't know that guy, you know, at all. And when he said, you know, Nicole, how I think that you can make this right, I think that what Pedro would want you to do is to be the best mom that you can be, because it sounds like you really loved your son a whole lot, even though he was really sick. And I just couldn't believe that that's what he said. You know, that was pretty amazing. And, like, I try to live up to that. Like, I really do try to be the best mom that I can be. And when I'm getting really irritated with my son, I think of that. You know, like, when he's being bad and not listening, I think of that amends. You know, like, that was how. That was my path, you know, to make this right. So, you know, be more patient, be more tolerant, you know, be the best mom I can be. And, you know, like, I've had some other good amends experiences as well, and I really think that's one of the places that I always went wrong. So I didn't make my amends. Like, I didn't want to go face the people that I had harmed, you know. And, you know, 10, like I said, we have, like, this cultish little thing we do. It's 10-step buddies. When we're disturbed, like, you know, couple of girls and I, like, when I'm disturbed, I need to immediately let somebody know that I'm in crazy town, and I need to ask them to help me get out of there, because what will happen is I'll stay there. You know, in crazy town, like, thinking the world's doing me wrong and everybody's doing it wrong, and get into this illusion that I'm some sort of victim, and I need to call a friend, and she needs to point out to me that, like, you know, I'm clearly looking at it from a whole the wrong way, and I need to get a better attitude and start you know, make amends if I need to, and then I move on. And I think that that's so helpful, because my alcoholic thinking will have me thinking some crazy stuff, like nobody likes me, and they're picking on me, you know, at work because they asked me to do something. Now they're picking on me, you know, like that's how I think, and that's how my illness comes at me today. It's not about fighting a drink anymore. You know, that problem has been removed. You know, in 11-step, like, something I've been doing too, like, actually meditating. Like, have this meditation that I do. I do it every morning, and I started reading spiritual material so I could start, like, watching my thoughts. And my dad makes fun of me, and he always comes in when I'm trying to meditate. He's always bothering me when I'm trying to meditate, and he goes, really annoying. You know, and that's something that, like, I had never done before. It's something new that I've been doing. And, you know, step 12 is the carry and the message, and trying to practice these principles in all my affairs, which is really difficult sometimes, and sometimes it's really easy, you know. It just depends on my willingness to practice these principles, you know, and I get the pleasure of sponsoring other women, you know, trying to help girls carry, you know, going into institutions and carrying the message. And I think that's, like, the biggest rewarding thing of all of it is, like I got my life back, and now I get to help other people get their life back, you know. And I don't know how God's going to use me. I had a situation recently at work. One of the cooks, like, he had relapsed, and it ended up that I had God use me to take him to the hospital. Now he's, you know, I just ran into him. He's in a place in Allentown, and he's, like, got fire, you know, light in his eyes again, and he's got a chance. And you know, like, I don't know how I'm going to be useful. And, you know, like, that's just my job now, is to just wake up in the morning, do my third step, and say, however you want to use me. Now, I don't do that every day, because I'm really stubborn. Sometimes I still try to do it my way. But, you know, that's basically the whole thing of it, you know, to practice these principles in all my affairs, see how I can be useful to other people, and stop thinking about myself. You know, it's not about fighting a drink anymore, because once you go through the steps, that problem is removed. You know, it just is. And I think I ran out of things to say, so I'm going to turn the meeting back over to Christian.